I'm Dan Runcie, the host and founder of Trapital, and it's been a while since we've done a true deep dive on Spotify. And we got to give credit where credit's due. The company had a strong year in 2024. So strong that it makes this quote from Trapital in November 2022 seem laughable at this point. Here's what I wrote. Quote, "It's been a rough year for Spotify stock. The current market cap is now $14 billion, down from nearly $70 billion in early 2021. At $14 billion, that's how much Apple and Amazon spent for these exclusive sports broadcast rights deals. How long until Apple or Amazon make a serious attempt to buy Spotify? It sounds crazy, but these behemoths spend so much money on content to acquire new customers. Wouldn't they want the audio platform that has nearly half a billion monthly active users?" End quote. Hey, I told you, it was a wild thing to hear about a company that had briefly surpassed $100 billion in market cap in November 2024, had a full year of profitability, and whose market cap might be valued at a higher price than all three major record labels combined. How did we get here? Well, that's a deeper conversation than what happened since November 22 until today. This is about everything that's been happening for Spotify for nearly 20 years of its existence. And that's what we're going to talk about today. I'm joined by an investor who goes by the name of Sleepwell Capital. I know his real name, but he goes by Sleepwell Capital, especially on Twitter. And if you follow or read any of his tweets there, he's always talking about his investments in music, consumer tech, and luxury. And he's also an independent artist and an engineer as well. And I've gotten to know him over the past couple years, sharing our thoughts about different companies in this space, but we often come back to Spotify and Universal Music Group, two companies that Sleepwell does have positions in, so it was great to finally have a conversation on record and talk about Spotify's journey up to where it is today. The opinions expressed here by Sleepwell are not investment advice. Sleepwell and Associates do actively invest in securities where they may have long or short positions in any of the companies or industries discussed on this episode, which are subject to change without any notice. Hope you enjoy this one. Let's dive in. This episode of Trapital is presented by State Farm. When you start a new business, your first reaction might be to say, woohoo, yes, or booyah. But one thing to say that could be a huge help is, like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. And just like that, State Farm will be there with the coverage that fits your need, whether your business is growing or just open its doors. State Farm agents are small business owners too, so they know what it takes. They can help you create an insurance plan that fits your small business needs and budget. And when you need help, State Farm is there to answer your small business questions or help you file a claim and get you back in business. With State Farm, you can worry less about the unexpected and focus more on your business. With a State Farm agent, you know someone is helping you achieve your goals. And just say, like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. We're here to talk about a company that has been profitable for an entire calendar year, hit $100 billion market cap. Did not think we would be saying those words about Spotify just a few years ago, but here we are. We're joined by Sleepwell Capital today. What's been your take on Spotify's year?
This year, they're going to hit a margin target that I had them getting to maybe in 2028 or 2029. So obviously the execution from the management team has been impressive and has surprised even the most optimistic analysts and investors that are following the company.
A couple of years ago, November 2022, the market cap for Spotify was around $14 billion. The stock was around $70 per share. Here we are now in this completely different position. Of course, there's a few things that they've been able to make changes with, whether it's increasing the prices, some layoffs post-pandemic, but that's been table stakes for a lot of companies in tech overall. But still, there's something else here that was able to help Spotify get to that level.
Yeah, that was also a point where there were a lot of companies that were trading really cheap on the technology sector back then, and Spotify obviously got thrown into that pile.
If we zoom out, I think there's probably a more interesting case because there's a lot that happened in the decade plus before this that can tell us a lot about Spotify's journey up to this point. Because as you and I both know, for tech companies that are trying to solve problems in music, there is a graveyard of companies that have tried to get licensing for music and it doesn't work out for them. Spotify was able to make progress where a lot of them didn't. People may think, okay, yeah, this is just another exit, but I think it stands a bit more unique than that because there's so many factors here that made this company stand out from others.
some of the reasons why they probably were able to pull that off. Obviously, luck always has a role to play in things like this. I think there's probably three reasons on why they were able to break through such a tough sector for startups. And I think the first one would be they were in the right place in the right time in terms of the product that they came up with. Back then, they had to, piracy was the big thing, right? So you had to compete with what was essentially a free product. And they were able to come up with something that was better than piracy. Originally, the model was going to be 100% ad-supported. Eventually, they pivot into the subscription model when they realized people weren't willing to pay for such a good product. But consumers absolutely love a product. It spread like wildfire. At that time, you had to get invites from somebody else when they were launching into a new market. And it was this whole big deal to be able to have access to that. So yeah, that's the first one on the product side. The other big reason is the support from the labels, which was a huge lift. Daniel Ek said multiple times, the thing that most surprised him, because he didn't know it was going to be so hard to convince the labels to bring them onto a product like this. It ended up taking multiple years to bring them on board. Once you had that support from the labels, that was such an important threshold that made the product all the more better. The final reason is you have to give credit to the management team. And in this case, specifically, it's a founder-led company, right? It's Daniel. But the other co-founder that sometimes gets overlooked, Martin Lorentzen, he was actually the one that originally funded the company from day one. And he was putting money into that company because startups were probably just not interested in investing in a company like this for the reasons we were just discussing. He had sold a company during the tech bubble at a very nice valuation, and he wanted something more aligned with his purpose. And I think that helped sustain the necessary losses that they had to take, especially early on.
I think the timing piece, especially because launch 2008, in Europe, 2011 in the US, there were companies that started a couple years before that, or even a couple years after that. There was that sweet spot that worked out really well for them. And the 3-year head start in Europe was key too, because licensing agreements are, relatively speaking, easier to come by in Europe. There are less bodies that you necessarily have to work with, and it's a bit more consolidated. And speaking about the licensing agreements themselves, the thing that I think helped them compared to, let's say, a company like Pandora, which was also quite popular in the early 2010s, is Spotify was more willing to accept the terms given early on and then work with that moving forward, even though they were getting hit by both the rights holders giving up roughly around 70 cents of every dollar paid to them. But then they were also giving money to the app stores as well. And I know that's a fight Ek and others have still been pushing on, but being willing to do that much early on, it was so different compared to Pandora that frankly spent a lot of their both actual capital, energy, and brand and everything just trying to push back on the royalties that I think it really hurt the company from a strategic perspective.
Definitely.
And I think the other thing too that sticks out is they were able to succeed when there are other tech platforms that have deep, huge pockets in the space, specifically looking at Apple Music, Amazon Music as well. There's a few things that are different there too. I think one of them probably taps back into the founder mode mentality that Ek has. It's very different than a company that is essentially a division of this $1 trillion tech company that is already printing money. Not that the leadership at those DSPs weren't trying to do innovative things, but yeah, it's a little different pressure when the goal is to help acquire customers so they can sell more shoes or sell more AWS subscriptions or AirPods, as opposed to Spotify trying to make this run as a standalone business.
Yes, I think you're right. It really does come down to a mission-driven company that's 100% focused on one thing. And Netflix is a good example here as well. I don't think it's a coincidence that the biggest streaming service in video is basically a pure play video streaming service, and everybody else is trying to catch up to them. In Spotify's, they had one mission, being the leader in music streaming and eventually in audio, but every single employee was working towards that mission. And as you said, if you're working for Amazon Music or Apple Music, it's basically not the same because you're part of a larger organization. It's a more stable job. And with some of these companies, I mean, you're literally a rounding error within that big corporation because of how much money they're making on other products. So it's nice for them to offer that. Somebody working at Spotify is going to be more driven to innovate, improve the product, fight to gain that incremental consumer, increase retention, and all those things. I think it's proven that.
Timing plays a factor in both, looking at Spotify and Netflix. They were early because that was their core product. In the early 2010s,
Apple is still focused on iTunes and selling individual songs. Amazon was also selling individual songs. I forget the exact year Amazon Music started, but Apple Music was 2015. Even though they acquired Beats and that gave them a little bit of an accelerated start, it was still a bit late to the game. Mm-hmm. Additionally, too, there's some geographic push there. Like, those companies are just much more Western world focused in a way that Spotify didn't have that same type of definition either.
Yeah, I believe they're not even growing anymore. There was some label commentary recently where they didn't actually say that literally, but you could tell by the way that they were explaining some of the recent growth that they saw in their most recent earnings call that it had to do with the slowdown in other streaming services. And obviously, we know Spotify's numbers because they're a public company. So you could triangulate and figure out that it came down to Amazon and Apple not growing anymore.
It was after the Q2 earnings, and you said something about calling out Spotify and YouTube growing. The other thing that's interesting, too, thinking about Spotify and its journey is it almost seems like a completely different world where the biggest artists in the world were releasing their albums and they did not come out that day on Spotify. It seems like a given now, but it wasn't that long ago that when Adele had tried to release her 21 album, she had only wanted it to be given to the paid subscribers and Spotify said no. And then for her next album after that, it was purely just a physical album. I think there were digital copies too, 2015 when that one came out. And then Taylor Swift had her music off Spotify. And then Beyonce had an exclusive with Tidal. Drake had a deal with Apple Music. So it's wild to think that was just 7-8 years ago. But yeah, we're now in this place where I think everyone realized once this company got to the size that it did and the reach that it did, you're no longer gaining something by making it exclusive. You're potentially hurting your reach and other revenue streams because of the reach and the revenue this platform generates.
People were still figuring out the right model. They were probably looking at the video industry where exclusives are really common and saying, hey, we should try this out and see what happens. But as we realized, it doesn't work. It doesn't work for the consumer because the consumer wants to have all the music in one place. And it doesn't work for the artist because at the end of the day, the artist wants to maximize their exposure to be at the most places where their fans are at and eventually be able to monetize that through touring. Big artists also make a ton of money from streaming. I think Taylor catalog is probably making $70 million per year just from Spotify alone. So it's definitely big money.
You see those charts that Spotify puts out in the Loud and Clear where it's like however many dozen artists are making $10 million plus on this platform, even if they're not naming the names who those artists are, right? Like there's only, granted that number continues to grow year over year. That's the way it is. And that's the power of the platform. And I think, too, the other thing that they've been able to do up until recent years, the amount of pricing power Spotify had over the years, in many ways, people saw it as such an issue. I think one of the things that people complained about the company for years was how low the prices were for streaming. Spend $10, you get one CD at the store, and you can spend $10 and you can consume everything. Now, the prices have started to shift. And even though it's only been a $2 increase from that $9.99 price point in the developed markets, that's still huge because in your most lucrative markets, that's a 20% revenue bump. Increase to profitability has made a huge impact without hurting retention.
From what they've said, it really didn't affect user churn. So that's very encouraging. And it's also nice to see that the competitors have also raised prices because I remember at maybe 2 years ago, a big part of this debate of whether Spotify was going to raise prices or not was people were saying Amazon and Apple and YouTube, they don't care about making money in these verticals. So they're not going to be raising prices. But I think that it's been proven that they actually want to make this profitable. Spotify has raised, I think it's 2 years in a row now, and we'll see. The last one, I think, was in April. So next April, we'll see if this basically becomes a yearly thing. I think that's super encouraging for the whole industry, right? Because the consumer likes the product. They've also increasingly added more and more value to the product, whether that's through personalization or adding other verticals like podcasts and audiobooks. So they've made the product better and increased the value. They have to be cognizant of what that sort of price to value gap is and make sure that it's not too big. And the way that you address that is by doing both of those things, improving the product and increasing prices. I think if you still look at music as a whole, as a form of entertainment, it's still very undervalued, right? You compare it to video, content per hour is probably like a 5x difference. The other thing that's important to keep in mind is that for music, you only need one, right? You only have to pay for Spotify. You only have to pay for Apple Music. In video, people are paying for 3, 4, or 5 services, right? So it adds up really quickly to like whatever, $50, $60 per month.
Because Netflix's introductory price to the US for the standard service is $22.99. It's almost double the current price of what Spotify is, even despite the price increases. Let's take a break for a chart metric stat of the week. Since we're talking about Spotify, and we now have some year-end data from Spotify, let's talk about the most streamed song on the platform in 2024. It's Billie Eilish's Birds of a Feather. It narrowly squeaked past Sabrina Carpenter's Espresso, and the numbers are pretty close. So Billie Eilish's song, which was the second single off of her Hit Me Hard and Soft album, had 1,775,172,881 streams, compared to Sabrina Carpenter's song, which had 1,774,525,704 listens on the platform. So we're talking just 650,000 streams, not a huge gap. And also, how does Sabrina Carpenter always get involved in these close races? It was just a few months back when she had dropped the album and Travis Scott and the whole Billboard Luminate thing going back and forth about what streams or what bundles are counted into which things. So interesting there. I will say, though, that Billie Eilish's song came out 1 month after the Sabrina Carpenter song. So the fact that a song came out in May was the song that had the most streams in the year says a lot. And of course, Billie Eilish, her music, the album, is a strong favorite for the upcoming Grammy Awards. So we'll see how it all plays out. Let's get back to the episode.
The one piece the major record labels have talked more about this past year is the free tier. Rob Stringer had spoken after one of Sony's either investor days or maybe it was after an earnings call, but he said that he wanted to eventually see some type of small fee that is attached to the free tier. And maybe he made a comparison to Netflix having their ad-supported tier the way they have it. The difference for Spotify, of course, though, is that Netflix added that on as a cheaper alternative to its $23 thing when there was no other alternative. Spotify or YouTube has both the paid and the ad-supported version. You'd be taking something away from what the consumers already have and potentially hurting one of the main growth levers that you have in order to get subscribers converting from free to paid. So I'm very interested to see how that one plays out.
Yeah, I'm actually a little bit skeptical that we end up in a place like that. Video, I think, is a little different than music because there's not that much free video content. There is some, but it's not that much. Or in music, we have Pandora, you have YouTube, right? You can listen to music in YouTube for free as app supported. So I don't think it would make sense for Spotify to take away that free tier. I hear the label's concerns because it has to do with just how low monetization is for ad supported, but it's such an important customer acquisition funnel. Free tier consumers migrate into the premium plans. So if you take that away, it might not be good for, certainly not for Spotify and even the industry as a whole.
There would definitely be a short-term hit if there was to be some type of thing that was there. And how willing are the stakeholders to accepting a short-term hit on this thing? So I see it just being very tough in general, but I also don't think it's a coincidence that the two largest listening platforms and the two largest contributors of revenue to the recorded music industry, I think Spotify and YouTube, both have large free tiers. The other thing too, there's also been the dramatic cost reduction too in a number of ways. It's podcasting strategy, but then overall it's marketing efforts too. These were huge expenditures that they had spent in 20, 21, even parts of 22 as well. And outside of maybe a few exclusive deals here and there, they've cut back from a lot of that, helping them just get more users and more growth at a time when it definitely got more competitive. From a high level, it's hard to say that it didn't work, but then also just now seeing where the company is just from a strategic perspective, you don't need to spend as much as you once did there.
It's probably a little early to say whether the podcasting push was very successful or not. I think it's going to take a couple more years still. They're actually not at the profitability levels that they want to be. And they've stopped investing a ton of money on these exclusive content deals. They also, similar to music, they realized it was better to maximize exposure and be everywhere. And obviously a lot of these deals were not financially, were maybe not as attractive. There was probably some benefit on the consumer subscriber growth and things like that. But I will say that from a sort of the tech infrastructure in podcasting, Megaphone and Anchor were probably some pretty good acquisitions for them.
On the actual exclusive strategy, there are two things that I'll talk about there. So I think the first is there were definitely some pushbacks. I know when they acquired The Ringer, they wanted to make some of the podcasts exclusive, but I'd heard that Bill Simmons and others were like, no, I'm not making my podcast.
Yeah, he didn't want to.
Now it's been interesting to see that whether it's podcasters that Spotify once did deals with or others, it's all these other companies that are now giving them nine-figure deals, like Alex Cooper from Call Her Daddy from Spotify. They're now doing a deal elsewhere, or even seeing the money that Travis and Jason Kelce got for their podcast outside of Spotify as well. So now everyone else is spending the type of money that Spotify was spending. The other piece too, it's probably a bit early to be able to look deeply at what Discovery Mode is able to generate, but from a standalone product, that has to be one of the more higher margin products that they have in that business, because they're essentially just turning on a lever one way or another. Then they get a 30% commission from the songs.
It is. And they actually, I think they haven't disclosed numbers for maybe 2 years or so. It's probably, at least from the gross margin side, it's probably the biggest contributor. The estimates that I have is that's probably 400-ish million business at this point. They call it marketplace. So it's basically three products, Discovery Mode being one, where you basically opt in certain songs from your catalog and it gets pushed through the algorithm and radio, etc. Instead of you paying for it, you actually get a lower commission in return. And then they also have Marquee, and the newer one is called Showcase, which is you actually pay for placement on those. It's a cost per click thing, and basically whatever release or song you're trying to push will come up in the home screen to what potentially new listeners. So that's been a huge contributor. And the other one that is more recent is the audiobook benefit, right? Because now Spotify is treating that as a bundle, and it's going to be next few years. They got into this huge fight with the NMPA, and I think the MLC has actually sued them. So they're going to go to court on that. But it's almost a $200 million benefit for them per year, just based on that change that they made in the way that they account for the plans being a bundle instead of a pure play music plan.
And that $200 million number is right around the number that NMPA and MLC had talked about that their songwriters would have as a hit take. And I think NMPA had said that the bundle would decrease the songwriter payments by $150 million annually. I feel like this will work itself out one way or another. I fully understand and respect where the NMPA or anyone that has a cut of the current Spotify revenue, anytime that there's anything that's additive or reductive, there's always going to be a debate about how the pie gets split.
The way that Spotify did this was a little sneaky, which I think is why one of the reasons why these big songwriter groups are getting incredibly mad, and it makes sense. But the counter argument and what Spotify is going to use to their favor is that this is no different than what Apple does with their bundle, or what YouTube does with their YouTube Premium bundle. And it's basically just written into the royalty calculations that the CRB has put out. And it's going to come down to whether they determine whether it's a valid bundle or not.
Because the other thing too is that those estimates don't account for the potential increase for the overall subscriber base, which everyone would get a cut of.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm sure Spotify will also use that as one of their sort of core arguments.
That one makes me think more broadly about Spotify. For years, Apple was often positioned as one of the main competitors. But as we talked about earlier, more and more it's becoming YouTube, especially video podcasting on YouTube and how important that platform has become. Spotify, of course, has made a tremendous investment in video podcasts, has been encouraging everyone to put more of their video onto that platform too. YouTube has also been trying to push itself to be more of a friend to the music industry. And at least from some of the early numbers I've seen, I think the numbers are probably going to be neck and neck soon for which of these companies are contributing more to the recorded music industry and the publishers as well. Spotify's number was around $8 or $7 billion, and YouTube's was around 6 or 7. I forget the exact numbers, and YouTube may even surpass at some point.
Spotify was 9 in 2023. 24 obviously hasn't come out, but we know YouTube is growing fast. First, as you mentioned, the video portion, right? A lot of people love to watch a video when they're listening to a song. And the other thing is that they have probably the deepest and most expansive catalog, right? You can literally find any music in there. And not only just an obscure recording from the 1970s that you won't find anywhere else, but you can find live performances, a Tiny Desk. There is some advantage in terms of the catalog that they have compared to all the other platforms.
And thinking about the two of them competing more and more like each other, YouTube Music having its own DSP-like platform, trying to compete a bit more like what we see there. Do you think that there's a future where Spotify incorporates even more of the YouTube aspects? I'm thinking specifically about comments and comments under songs.
They have comments on the podcasting side. Yeah, they do. I'm not sure if they're going to eventually incorporate that into music. I do know Spotify, as a core belief to the company, they don't want to get too much into social. To the extent that is still true, there's probably only so much they would push into. And the reason is that there's people always talk about social music like being so important and whatnot, but becoming a social platform has all these other trade-offs that we forget usually. And you have to start policing a lot of things, and it becomes a whole different kind of product, right? So there are some risks to really pushing into something like that. But we have seen Spotify do things that are making it look more like a YouTube, right? As you said, video, and they've also started pushing into music videos. I think that's being rolled out in various markets right now. They recognize that YouTube is doing a lot of things, and to the extent that's going to help them, it makes sense that they incorporate a lot of that as well. And YouTube has also copied a lot of things that Spotify has done, right? Especially in YouTube Music. And one other thing that I forgot to mention, and I think it's sometimes gets overlooked, because you'll see many times that YouTube reports their total subscribers. It was like 100 million. Because a lot of people are just paying for that, for not seeing any ads in YouTube, but they're not necessarily using YouTube Music, even though they're technically considered a subscriber.
They want to be able to watch their long form, whatever, video essays, podcast, any of the various things on that platform, and just not deal with ads.
Exactly.
On the Spotify side, maybe some of these features are the types of things that may make sense for the long discussed superfan tier, right? That's the one thing that the majors keep on pushing. They want to be able to have some type of way to segment these customers. And since Spotify and the DSPs are the ones that have the relationship with the customers directly, as opposed to the record labels, I know they're trying to change some of that, but at least traditionally the way it lives now, those are the type of things that fans would probably value if you're going to charge more for it on top of the regular subscription fee.
Exactly. I've been surprised at how long it's taken for that superfan tier to get rolled out, because I feel like they've been talking about it for way too long now. But I know they were testing different things and the pricing, how much more expensive than the standard it's going to be at. They have to figure that out, as well as what they're gonna include. I think it makes a lot of sense, right? Because you want to be able to monetize these super, super fans that are willing and able to pay more for extra features, extra content, to have a closer relationship to their favorite artists. So I don't think just throwing in hi-fi and some special playlist features or something is going to be enough. I think they probably need to come up with something more exclusive to be able to just really expand that relationship with your top artist. The National is one of my favorite artists. And if they ask me to pay 50% more, but I got to listen to their album a week before everyone else, I would probably do that, right? So that's some of the ways that they could get creative. How do you think, in terms of the features and whatnot, what have you heard could potentially come?
What I've heard is the National example that you just brought up there, right? I was talking to a DSP head not too long ago, and it asked me, what were my thoughts on that exact model? If there are particular artists that you like, you get a week early access to them and you pay some type of premium for that. I think the pushback on that was, if you had that type of access and you were paying that premium, would you keep that premium just continued moving forward, or would you only start it and stop it when the National releases new music? And I think that was one of the potential rubs that was there. And there was some internal considerations on because you're now taking something away that fans felt they already had access to in a way. I think they were still building it and figuring it out. And that's part of why I think we've continued to hear about this, but just never heard anything firm. I remember when UMG had their capital markets day a couple months back, and one of their slides was showing their streaming 1.0 and streaming 2.0. Streaming 1.0 was pretty much everything that we've been talking about in this conversation. Streaming 2.0 was trying to shift more into what are those things that the fans actually want. I think the tough thing is now, in many ways, the quote-unquote super fans have self-selected into the things that super fans actually do buy, like concert tickets and merchandise and vinyl and stuff like that. So what is that thing that you are going to offer that isn't one of those things already where they're getting elsewhere?
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of testing and seeing what's working and what's not, I think. So we'll see.
As we started this conversation, they recently hit the 100 billion market cap milestone. I think it's now trading a little bit under that. But there's definitely been some pushback about the price itself, specifically the PE ratio. It is, I think, well over 100, maybe around 120, 130. I forget the exact number, but you compare that to some of the other companies we're talking about, Netflix, or you compare that to other big tech companies. It is quite different where Netflix, I think, is 50x. I think Meta and others are around like 25, 26. And there could be a number of reasons why some people feel that there is continued growth opportunities for Spotify, especially given that some people see this as the early innings of a potentially long tail of them being able to benefit from some of the changes that we just discussed here. There's also just the continued value that they can accrue as the de facto market leader, depending on how things go with YouTube, as we talked about here. But what's your take on that? Do you think that the pushback is fair on the stock price itself?
I don't agree with that view, and mainly because for a company like Spotify, which is has some pretty healthy revenue growth and has just started to inflect higher on margins, you can basically lay out those numbers and what that translates to in terms of the potential earnings growth that they're going to see over the next, call it 5 years. And you can quickly see that the earnings are going to grow exponentially, basically. So if you look at the PE ratio, it's basically just a static picture of where their earnings are right now. And that's why it looks high. But if you actually look to, let's say, 2027, just a couple of years out, the market expects Spotify, and this is basically the average of what the financial analyst community is forecasting Spotify to earn in terms of the earnings per share, it's going to be around $13. You can see how that quickly from 120, it comes down to 37, making it, quote unquote, a little bit more digestible. And then it really just becomes a question of what you're forecasting Spotify to grow over the next 10 years. The market it's a discounting mechanism, and it's always forward looking. And it's not just looking at this year or next year, it's actually looking well into the future. So if the expectations are high for Spotify to keep growing at a very healthy percentage in terms of revenue, and it makes sense for them to trade at what seems like a high current multiple.
There was a point a year and a half ago where Spotify had a very similar market cap to Universal Music Group. And there was an interesting discussion on, would you rather own stock in UMG, considering they had recently went public themselves in 2021, or would you rather own in Spotify? And it went into a deeper conversation of, okay, would you rather own the supplier? Would you rather own the retailer? And people brought up plenty of analogies there. Interesting, healthy debate. Now we fast forward a year later, where UMG, at least from the public markets perspective and the stock performance, it has been a pretty rough year, to say the least. And we started to see more of that separation from their stock compared to the stock performance specifically of Spotify. And I shouldn't just say UMG, to be clear. I think Warner Music Group stock has also had a bit of a tough go around as well. But we alluded to a bit of it just with some of the other DSPs that didn't have as strong of a year. But there's other revenue streams that the major record labels rely on. But still, streaming is so core to it. Did you expect it to play out this way?
I'd like to say I did. I follow both. For full disclosure, I am invested in both companies, but my bet has always been that Spotify was going to be the long-term winner. I think the difference in market cap has probably gotten a little bit stretched at this point. You and I were just talking before recording that if you look at Spotify's market cap and compare that to the three labels, Sony is a little hard because it's got a bunch of different stuff inside of it as a conglomerate, but Spotify is probably bigger, right? It really just does beg the question of why that difference is. And I think for the labels this year has been, they really disappointed the market in terms of their growth expectations. Both Warner and UMG at different points when they reported earnings came in at what, below what the market was expecting. So that hit their stock price. And a lot of people love to compare what Spotify is reporting to what the labels are reporting. And that spread became just so big. And they were getting questions on Spotify's reporting 20% revenue growth. Why are you growing at 9%, right? It hasn't been an easy year for their stock price. But anything that Spotify and the other DSPs are able to achieve in terms of growing that pie, whether it continually increasing prices or introducing all these new plans, that's going to benefit the labels, right? So it's more about them working together to keep growing the industry, and it's going to benefit the artists as well. So I'm pretty optimistic on just the growth of the industry as a whole.
I think we should also call out the growth of the indie market as well. The indies monetize through Spotify, right?
Exactly.
The indies, by definition, do not monetize through the major labels. So that's why we're starting to see more and more of these transitions. So they're clearly making moves to try to address it. This was fun. I'm glad we were able to do this. You and I were probably going to circle back at some point. But
absolutely.
Sleep well, Capital. Appreciate you joining us for this one. This is a lot of fun.
Thank you, Dan. Talk soon.
Talk soon. And that's a wrap. Our first episode of 2025. Really excited about everything that we have coming up this year. Thanks again to our editing team. Thanks again to our producers who helped make this show possible. Thanks again to Sleepwell Capital for joining us. Make sure you follow along at Sleepwell Cap on X for any of his additional insights. And thank you for listening. Again, if you enjoy this show, please leave us a review. And if you really like this show, leave a comment on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get podcasts. The more people that you tell about this show, the more people that continue to learn about it. And that's how we continue to reach and impact more people. Thanks again. Talk to you next time.